From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And as one whose heart has ached for the past 10 years over the agony of Vietnam, I will halt the senseless bombing of Indochina on inaugural day.
George McGovern, the former senator and Democratic presidential candidate, will join us to talk about the 2008 race and the commission he chaired in 1968 that helped transform how the Democratic Party chooses its presidential nominee. We'll also speak with former superdelegate, columnist, and author Jim Hightower, his latest book, Swim Against the Current. And we'll be joined by the man who's been called the Elvis of cultural theory, widely considered one of Europe's leading intellectuals, Slavoj Žižek. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush says he's agreed to boost Polish military aid in return for Poland's cooperation in hosting part of a U.S. missile shield. Appearing with Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk on Monday, Bush committed to reaching a final agreement before leaving office.
Well, I think there's a commitment to a system that respects Polish sovereignty, will ensure that the people of Poland will, you know, not be subjected to any undue security risks, that the system is necessary to deal with the realities of the threats. Obviously, there's a lot of work to do because many times, you know, a strategy on paper is a little different from the details, and so our experts are working through the system to make sure that, you know, the people of Poland are comfortable with the idea.
Poland would host at least 10 missiles as part of the deal. Critics say the U.S. is pushing the missile system as a first-strike weapon against Iran. Public opinion polls continue to show majority opposition in both Poland and the Czech Republic, the other planned host. Here in New York, Governor Eliot Spitzer's political career is in jeopardy following the disclosure he was a client of a high-end prostitution ring. Authorities say Spitzer was caught in a federal wiretap arranging a meeting with a prostitute at a Washington hotel last month. On Monday, Spitzer issued a brief apology at his Manhattan office.
I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong. I apologize first and most importantly to my family. I apologize to the public, whom I promised better. I do not believe that politics in the long run is about individuals. It is about ideas, the public good, and doing what is best for the state of New York. But I have disappointed and failed to live up to the standard I expected of myself. I must now dedicate some time to regain the trust of my family.
Governor Spitzer didn't address the allegations directly or say if he would step down. He has not been charged with any crime, but could face prosecution for money laundering and soliciting prostitution. If he were to step down, Lieutenant Governor David Paterson would become the governor, would become the first black governor of New York. He would also become the first blind governor in the country. On the campaign trail, Mississippi holds a primary today in the deadlocked Democratic presidential race. 33 delegates are at stake. It's the last primary for another 6 weeks until Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton face off in Pennsylvania. On Monday, Obama dismissed comments from the Clinton campaign that he would make an optimal vice presidential running partner on a Clinton-led ticket.
I've won twice as many states as Senator Clinton. I've won more of the popular vote than Senator Clinton. I have more delegates than Senator Clinton. So I don't know how somebody who's in second place is offering the vice presidency to the person who's in first place.
In other campaign news, a 17-year-old girl featured in the Clinton campaign's infamous 3 a.m. phone call has announced she supports Obama. The ad features images of children asleep and asks viewers who they'd want answering an early morning White House phone call. The teen, Casey Knowles, was just 8 years old when the footage was filmed. She's now working as a campaign volunteer for Obama.
Well, originally I felt kind of bad, like I'm being disloyal to Senator Obama, because I didn't know, obviously, that this was going to happen, but I felt a little bad that my image was being used in this fear-mongering message. But I don't think that this ad was the most classy move on her part. I think it was kind of a low-brow sort of move. I'm not a big fan of the ad and the tactic.
The House Judiciary Committee has filed suit to enforce subpoenas of two White House aides in the probe of the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys. White House Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton and former counsel Harriet Myers ignored the subpoenas after President Bush claimed executive privilege protects them from testifying. It's the first time either chamber of Congress has sued the executive branch to enforce a subpoena. An Oklahoma state legislator is coming under criticism for a speech in which she says homosexuals are destroying the United States and are more dangerous than terrorists. Republican State Representative Sally Kern was addressing a small audience when she was secretly recorded.
Studies show that no society that has totally embraced homosexuality has lasted more than, you know, a few decades. So it's the death knell of this country. I honestly think it's the biggest threat, even that our nation has, even more so than terrorism or Islam, which I think is a big threat. If you've got cancer or something in your little toe, do you say, well, you know, I'm just going to forget about it because the rest of me's fine? It spreads, okay? And this stuff is deadly, and it's spreading, and it will destroy our young people. It will destroy this nation.
The Oklahoma Republican State Representative Sally Kern has confirmed she made the comments and has refused to apologize. In Israel and the occupied territories, violence in the Gaza Strip has eased amidst Israeli-Palestinian talks for a ceasefire. Egyptian officials are reportedly mediating the discussion between Israeli officials and members of Hamas. Palestinians are calling for an end to Israeli military attacks and the lifting of the intensified Gaza blockade. In Iraq, at least 20 people were killed in attacks Monday, including 8 U.S. service members. It was the worst single-day toll for the U.S. military this year. Back in Washington, House Oversight Committee Chair Henry Waxman is calling for a sweeping new probe of the private military contractor Blackwater Worldwide. On Monday, Waxman asked the IRS and the Labor Department to investigate Blackwater's classification of its mercenaries as independent contractors rather than employees. The move has allowed Blackwater to avoid up to $50 million in taxes and qualify for hundreds of millions in contracts reserved for small businesses. In other Iraq news, a new Pentagon review has found no evidence of a link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. The study analyzed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi documents captured following the U.S. invasion of Iraq. In September 2002, then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the Bush administration had bulletproof evidence of cooperation between al-Qaeda and Iraq. A new congressional study has found fresh evidence linking illnesses in Gulf War vets to exposure to pesticides and nerve agents. Researchers say one-third of Gulf War veterans experience fatigue, muscle pain, sleep issues, rashes, and breathing problems. Former White House aide Karl Rove was treated to a hostile reception Sunday in a speech at the University of Iowa. Rove was interrupted several times as he spoke before more than 1,000 people. Two audience members were removed after they tried to perform what they called a citizen's arrest for Rove's involvement in Bush's administration crimes. Rove was asked if he has ever shed a tear over the war in Iraq. Rove said he's cried for the parents of soldiers who support the war effort. Rove was paid $40,000 for the speech. Near the end of his talk, one audience member yelled, "Can we have our $40,000 back?" Rove replied, "No, you can't." The Associated Press has revealed considerable traces of pharmaceutical drugs have been found in the drinking water supplies of at least 41 million Americans. The AP investigation found drugs, including antibiotics, anticonvulsants, mood stabilizers, and sex hormones, in the water supplies of 24 major metropolitan areas. The overall concentrations were small, measured in parts per billion or trillion. But experts say the findings raise concerns of long-term health effects. And the Wall Street Journal has revealed the National Security Agency's spying on U.S. citizens has been more extensive than previously disclosed. Current and former intelligence officials say the NSA now monitors a huge collection of data, including emails, internet searches, bank transfers, credit card transactions, travel itineraries, and telephone records. The data is amalgamated in search for suspicious activity. Most of it comes from other agencies or private companies. Some of the data is supplied by several undisclosed so-called black programs, many established before the 9/11 attacks. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars.
Look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper, even when the pads are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do. I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem. I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus. Me and my friend made a comic book, and guess how long it took? I can do anything that I want, cause look. I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone, on the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, look at me. Just called to say that it's good to be alive in such a small world. I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run a business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, cause I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule.
Flobots, handlebars here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations in Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take is over 150R. And you can read the headlines in Spanish at our website. Well, voters head to the polls today in Mississippi for another closely watched primary between Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. It's the last primary before Pennsylvania votes on April 22nd. Senator Obama is expected to win in Mississippi and slightly increase his delegate lead. But the Associated Press reports neither Obama nor Clinton will be able to win enough pledged delegates to win the nomination prior to the convention, even if Florida and Michigan hold a new round of voting. This means the nomination will rest in the hands of the party's nearly 800 superdelegates. Today, we're going to be joined by former senator and presidential candidate George McGovern, 4 years prior to his 1972 run for the White House. McGovern chaired the Commission on Party Structure and Delegate Selection. The McGovern Commission helped transform how the party chose its presidential nominee. In 1982, the Democratic National Committee approved a new series of reforms, including the establishment of superdelegates, to give the party more direct control over the selection of presidential candidates. To talk more about the presidential race and selection process, George McGovern joins us in the Firehouse studio. He is former U.S. Senator from South Dakota. In 72, he lost to Richard Nixon in the presidential election. He's endorsed Senator Hillary Clinton. We are also joined by Jim Hightower, the syndicated columnist, author, radio commentator. His latest book is Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. He served two terms as Texas Agriculture Commissioner and served as a superdelegate at the 1992 Democratic Convention. He has endorsed Senator Barack Obama for president. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! But I want to go back first to that 1968 commission that Senator McGovern, you chaired before you ran for president, that really transformed the way the Democratic presidential candidate was chosen. How did it happen? What did you decide then?
The basic change that that reform commission recommended, which was adopted by the party and is still in place 35 years later, was that those delegate slates that pick the nominee of the party for president had to have some reasonable relationship to the population of the state. In other words, if half the state were women and half were men, the delegates should be roughly the same. We didn't set up percentage quotas, but we set a reasonable relationship. If a state had 20% black people, then the delegation from that state should be roughly 20% black. What we found when we started our work is that some of the states, many of them, had the delegates picked by one person, usually or a little group of white middle-class, middle-aged males. I'm not against people like that. I was one myself at that time. But we have a much better balance now. The 72 convention, which was the first one to come under the new McGovern reforms, was pretty evenly balanced between men and women. You looked out over that convention floor. We also said that there should be some consideration given to age groups. Some of the biggest delegations to the 68 convention didn't have a single person 30 years of age or under, even though the transcendent issue of that time was the war in Vietnam, where everybody was under 30. So we corrected some serious imbalances in the way the delegations were put together.
This followed 1964 Atlantic City Convention. Fannie Lou Hamer, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, wanting to seat a new delegation to represent Mississippi.
Yes, that's correct. The commission was mandated by the 68 convention, and all of the candidates at that convention supported it, including Hubert Humphrey, who was our nominee that year, Gene McCarthy. I had taken over Bobby Kennedy's delegation after he died. It was a bold thing to do since I was running for re-election to the United States Senate in South Dakota, but I survived it and survived the Reform Commission, and I'm very proud of what that commission did.
And so compare it to what we have today and the situation now with delegates and superdelegates, which you didn't decide on in 1968.
No, the superdelegates were not part of the McGovern reforms, but they were a concession some years later to the party regulars who thought that certain people should automatically be delegates. If you were the governor of a state, if you were a United States senator, if you were the state chairperson, you should automatically be a delegate, up to a percentage of one-fourth of the total number of delegates. There always had to be three-fourths of the delegates going to the national convention who were elected according to our reform rules. But we made that one concession. I think one of the things that produced it, we discovered in 72, for example, that a 19-year-old McGovern young woman defeated Tip O'Neill in his home district of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, Tip O'Neill should have been at the Democratic National Convention. Averill Harriman, running in New York, was defeated by another young person, a McGovern delegate.
Now, what's wrong with us?
Nothing wrong with it, but we thought maybe as a concession to age and wisdom and stature and all of that business, that we should make a 1/4 concession. So we said 1/4 of the concession can be what we now call superdelegates.
Some say perhaps the superdelegates were chosen in reaction to 1972, your bid, and Carter's bid as well, that maybe the establishment did not favor you and wanted more of a say. Sort of like the House of Commons versus the House of Lords.
Not only some say that, that's absolutely the truth. It was a reaction to what they thought were candidates picked by young people, anti-war people, crusaders, and that the people that work at politics 365 days out of the year, like a senator or a congressman or a governor, were not making it to the conventions. So I want to confess that I supported that concession. I thought it was something we could live with, and so far it hasn't done any damage.
Do you think it hurt you in 1972? You were the first really election, presidential election, since your presidential since the commission changed the voting system, that you had to race all the way to the convention, as we're seeing right now, it looks
I think it probably did hurt us some in 72, and it added to the image of me as an outsider. I never saw myself as an outsider. I organized the Democratic Party in South Dakota. I worked my tail off to do that. I was an organizational man. I'm not boasting about that. I'm just stating a fact that I was not an outsider. They wouldn't have asked me to chair that commission if they had seen me as an outsider. I did that under the urging of the late Hubert Humphrey and Fred Harris, who was our national Democratic chairman at that time. Neither one of those were outsiders either.
We're talking to Senator George McGovern. We're going to go to a brief break. Then when we come back, he will be joined by a former superdelegate himself. I don't know if that's how he defines himself these days, though it seems to become increasingly relevant. His new book is called Swim Against the Current. He's the former agricultural commissioner of Texas, Jim Hightower. Stay with us. Frog, The Doors, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests in studio are George McGovern, the former senator, Democratic presidential candidate of 1972. He has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. Jim Hightower is also with us, the syndicated columnist, rabble-rouser, national radio commentator, best-selling author. He has just gone on the road with his new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Jim, you were a superdelegate, and you have been stumping for Barack Obama. Why?
Well, superdelegate, I'm going to have to freshen up my resume, I think. I don't have that listed on there, but I felt really super about it in 1992. It didn't mean anything back then.
Who chose you?
Just as Senator McGovern was indicating, you're chosen by the party officials. I had just been agriculture commissioner, and so was allowed. I didn't want to take a slot of a real delegate, so that it was possible to slip me in there into that. And as I say, it didn't mean a damn thing. You were still the same sort of delegate. You had the same level of vote and everything. But this time, it's different. And yeah, I support Barack Obama. To me, the significant thing about the Obama phenomena is not him, it's the phenomena. The fact that we have millions of new voters, excited voters, people who've not been voting in the past, but who feel that this time they matter. And that they have a potential not just to send Obama to the White House, but for them to go into the White House, not just the party operatives, not just the usual special interests, but for the people themselves to be able to go in. I don't think anybody thinks that Obama, and I don't even think he thinks that there's any sainthood here, there's any magic going to come just by him being president. But with him, I think we've got a potential to have a real progressive government because the people themselves would be a force in it.
Senator George McGovern, you've made a different decision. You've endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Well, I endorsed Hillary last October, and I have to say that friendship had a lot to do with it. She and her then-boyfriend, a guy by the name of Bill Clinton, were the coordinators of the McGovern campaign in Texas in 1972. That was a brave undertaking. As Jim Hightower can testify, trying to sell George McGovern in Texas in 1972 was a daunting task. They worked their fannies off for me in 72 all across that state. And so when she decided to run for president, in a sense, it was kind of a, it's my turn now. I have to tell you this, Jim, that I have 10 grandchildren. All 10 of them are working for Barack Obama. That's an indication of the influence I have in my own family. I've got 3 daughters and 1 son. They're all working for Barack. So I'm the old fogey in the McGovern family this year, unlike 72 when I was way out in front. But I agree with everything Jim Hightower has said here, that Barack Obama has touched on a theme and a style and a content to his program that has brought millions of new people into the fold. That's precisely what I did in 1972. We ran into all kinds of trouble once I was nominated, but we stirred many of the same currents that are moving now. So I'll be happy to support either Hillary or Barack, depending on which one wins the nomination. And whichever one wins, we'll have a candidate that's a country mile ahead of the opposition.
Senator McGovern, if you were endorsing today, who would you endorse?
I would stay with Hillary. I don't change my mind on things like this in the middle of the battle. I made the decision to back her, and I'll stay with her. I don't want to be jumping around from one candidate to another. And as I said, we've got 2 excellent candidates here, both well qualified, and I'll be out campaigning for whichever one wins. Am I ducking your question? Yes.
Why?
Because I want to stay with the person I chose 6 months ago.
There was an interesting piece in the New York Times about how your whole group in 1972, they're coming together around Hillary Clinton's 72 McGovern team rallies for one of its own. It says Frank Herrera, a prominent lawyer in Texas, was sitting at home 2 Saturdays ago when he received a phone call. The voice at the end of the line was that of an old friend from Senator George McGovern's 72 presidential campaign, who'd since become the godfather, at least, to some of the Democratic Party. "We've been with you all these years," former President Bill Clinton said. According turning to Herrera. Now the time has come for you to be with us. Talking about Herrera, going back to your 1972 campaign, Gary Morrow, veteran Texas Democrat who ran the Youth for McGovern operation, now Mrs. Clinton's state director, Roy Spence, Austin advertising executive who created advertisements for the McGovern campaign, deeply involved in Clinton's media strategy in Texas. Even a receptionist from the McGovern campaign, Nancy Williams, has been called back to lend a hand to the Clinton operation, conducting delegate training sessions from the campaign's headquarters in Austin.
Well, that makes me feel good, because I've noticed over the years that while we took a terrific beating at the hands of Richard Nixon in the fall, those so-called McGovern people are still in there battling for better government, for stronger candidates. I think they'll be there the rest of their lives. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, that I stand with Hillary in this effort, because I've got a long memory, and I know who stood for me 35 years ago.
Do you think Barack Obama would have?
I think he's a marvelous figure on the political scene. I had never met him at the time I endorsed Hillary. I hadn't even shaken hands with him at that time, but I've been very impressed with him. I see some of the same things in him that Jim Hightower does, and I'm glad he's a candidate this year. I think he has shaken things up, and whether we win or lose with that particular candidacy, he's already contributed a lot to the enrichment of American politics.
I wanted to get your quick comment, Senator McGovern, on something that's playing out right now in the state you were visiting, in New York. And, of course, it's about the governor, Governor Eliot Spitzer. I actually was in Albany yesterday as news of this, the allegations that he was caught in a federal sting calling a escort service. I was in Albany, interestingly enough, to give a keynote along with Governor Spitzer on the issue of reproductive rights and politics. 1,000 people were there, and he canceled. It was yesterday morning. David Paterson, who could become the next governor of New York, was also there speaking, the lieutenant governor. But do you see a danger of a kind of explosion within the Democratic Party?
I don't think it's going to explode the Democratic Party. What we're talking about here is a sin that's as old as human beings. The two people I feel the sorriest for are the governor and his wife. This is going to be a tough thing for them. I hope they can survive it. But Governor Spitzer has had an almost flawless public record over the years. I don't know of any scandal that has touched this man. It seems like that in politics, when the Republicans get into trouble with sin, it's over money. Somebody misplaced $1 billion or $300 million or whatever it is. When the Democrats get in trouble, it's sex. And
well, you have Senator Vitter from Louisiana got in trouble with an escort. He's still senator from Louisiana, just introduced legislation that Native American women can't have abortions on with federal funding. And then, of course, you have the scandal around Larry Craig, which was very different. But
look,
he remains senator.
One of the most honored figures in the Bible was King David, the man that wrote those wonderful Psalms. And who you go to Israel today and you stay in the King David Hotel in Israel. He had got a crush on the wife of one of his lieutenants, and he sent the poor guy up to the battlefront and got him killed so he could have his wife. Eliot Spitzer hasn't done anything like that. I'm not trying to minimize this.
Are you comparing Eliot Spitzer to King David?
Yeah, in a way. King David asked God to forgive him, and I believe he did. He asked the people to forgive him, and I believe they did. And he went on to become a great religious and political leader of the Israelis. So we have to take these things in some kind of perspective. Should the governor have thought more carefully about what he was doing before he got mixed up with this woman? Of course he should. So should King David. have thought more carefully about his actions. But this is a sin, not a crime, as I understand it. I don't think he's accused of any crimes. I think it's obviously a sin and something that's very embarrassing and horrendous for his wife and his family. But I'm going to leave it in their judgment. I'm not going to try to pass judgment on somebody else's sin.
Jim Hightower.
Maybe the greatest sin here was that it was not just a street prostitute, but a $5,000 an hour prostitute. You know, I mean, people can't make their house payments, and this guy's laying down $5,000. I don't know about you, George, but I'd be worried. $5,000. What if you ran over a couple of minutes? I mean, is it another $5,000?
Well, I don't know.
Speaking of sin, perhaps it's something you considered a sin decades ago, the Vietnam War. I wanted to ask, bringing it to the 2008 presidential race, Henry Kissinger has endorsed John McCain. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I worry about John McCain. He's one of the few people in public life that still thinks the war in Vietnam was a good idea. It was an utter, unmitigated disaster. And anyone who can't see that after all these years, I have some questions about in terms of where they may lead us in the future. He voted for the war in Iraq and not only thinks that was a good idea, he wants more troops over there. I think it was a disastrous idea and that we ought to be bringing our troops home, not talking about surges and sending more troops over there to be shot at. The paper today has a story that five soldiers were in a market in Baghdad yesterday, got blown up by one of these hand bombs. We're never going to have peace and stability in Iraq until we get our troops out of there. Part of the trouble is a revolt on the part of the people of Iraq against the presence of a foreign army in their country. You can always find a few people who are glad they're there, but they're a small minority, according to the polls. So rather than have Senator McCain still basking in the glories of Vietnam and still supporting this unfortunate war in Iraq, I think we need somebody like Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton who say if they're elected, they're going to get the troops out of there.
And do you think they are? They have not talked about immediate withdrawal.
No, they haven't, and I wish they would. I wish I'd like to have a time certain. I wrote a book with one of our best Middle East experts, Bill Polk, in which we called a year and a half ago for a six-month withdrawal period. There's no reason why it should take more than 6 months. People ask how we're going to do it. One way to do it is to put them in trucks and head for the border. That's how we got in there.
Jim Hightower, your book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, is about going against the current. Talk about.
Well, there's all this excitement about change in this political election year, but what Senator McGovern was indicating earlier was a lot of the people who were involved in his campaign have been a part of change all of those years and will continue to be. And we have a whole new generation as well of people who didn't just start with the Obama campaign, didn't just start this year, but have been developing change at a grassroots level for some time in the political sphere, in business, in healthcare, in religion, even in banking in a lot of different ways. And Susan DeMarco and I have, we've come across these people in our many travels as we go around the country. And we realize these are the mutts and mavericks that really make up America and the very best spirit of people who buck the system. And we thought, well, why not tell their stories?
Well, tell us some of their stories. You talk about escaping the corporate tentacles.
Well, you take business. We write about a fellow, Chris Johnson, who is a pharmacist making $100,000 a year with a chain drugstore down in Texas. And he said it just made me sick to my stomach. And what made him sick was people would come up with their prescriptions. He would fill them, present them to him, and present the bill. And they would they would back away and walk out without their money, without their prescription. They couldn't afford them. Yet, as a corporate functionary, he had no ability to say, well, wait a minute, we'll work something out here. And so he spun off and created MedSavers, a little company that is a single pharmacy, bare-bones operation, serving people who have no insurance at all or whose policies don't include prescriptions, primarily generic drugs. And he's able to provide medicine, for example, a pill that sells for $59 for 90 capsules. He can sell for $16. He knew the obscene profits that were built into those medicines, and he's able to cut that down to a manageable level for families. He feels better about himself. He's got his hours set now so he can be at home with his children in the morning for breakfast, take them to school, be at home, put them to bed. His whole life has improved. He has a relationship with the people who come in. They shoot the breeze. It's a more personal thing, and he says it's a matter of setting your work according to your values. And people are doing that all across the country. People are in business, in politics, and across the board.
You talk about the conscience of an evangelical.
Well, this is one of the more remarkable things that the progressive side has not figured out yet. There's a profound change taking place among evangelical Christians, really a generational change. They speak of young people, by which they mean younger than 50. But the older leaders, primarily political leaders of the evangelical movement, James Dobson, Pat Robertson, these folks, are so out of touch with their own movement that the movement is now going around them. And we write about a fellow, Rich Cizik. He's the chief lobbyist of the National Association of Evangelicals in Washington, D.C. This is the main line. These are not the liberals. This is the main line. 30 million people, 45,000 churches. He had what he calls a second altar call when he went to a scientific meeting in London on global warming. He was convinced, he was overwhelmed by the science. And then he realized, I have to go talk about this. I can't just be quiet because the Bible is very clear. You must be the steward. You have to take care of the garden. And obviously, we're not taking care of the garden. And so it became a biblical awakening. That's how it reached them. But however it reached them, it doesn't much matter because the result is that evangelical leaders, particularly some of the younger ones, are now teaming up with Nobel Prize-winning scientists to present a very bold agenda on not just that we must personally take responsibility, but they talk of structural sin, by which they mean corporations. We've got to reel in these corporate powers and governments that are sanctioning these corporate actions to be better stewards of our world.
Clean elections?
Oh, this is the most wonderful story in America, I think, and underreported except on great shows like Democracy Now. People say, oh, well, you can't get the corrupt money out of politics. They find loopholes around them. Well, you got to tell that to the people of Maine and North Carolina and New Mexico and Arizona, Connecticut and other states and cities that have passed public financing of their elections. And it just has remarkable results. In Maine, for example, they've now had four election cycles with public financing, meaning if you don't take private money, you get an equivalent sum of money that makes you competitive from public funds. The result in Maine has been that now 83% of their Senate, 84% of their House have been elected without taking a dime in corporate money. And it's totally changed the politics of that state. North Carolina has done it just for their judicial elections. And the result of that, by the way, they had a real fun thing to win it. The Republicans in the legislature had opposed it as a bloc. And one of their strategies of the coalition that was pushing the clean election alternative was to get school teachers to call their former students who were in the legislature and say, Johnny, don't make me have to come to Raleigh. Did you learn anything that I taught you? But one more point, that now in North Carolina, they've had two election cycles. The six seats up in 2004 on the Supreme Court and Appeals Court down there, five were elected without corporate money. And in the last election, six of the five were elected again, including four women. We now have a woman, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. She says clearly, without public financing, I could not have done it.
Finally, Senator McGovern, two big stories of this year, not counting how many votes Barack Obama has, how many votes Hillary Clinton has in each caucus and primary, and even John McCain, but adding them all together, this phenomenal explosion of new voters coming in or voters returning. That's one part. The other part, what Jim is referring to right now, is also the money. The hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions so far, well over, that is being spent. Do you ever think we'll see clean campaign funding, public campaign financing?
I think that's the trend. It is almost mind-boggling, the amount of money that has been raised already by these candidates. I read where, I think it was Barack, had raised $50 million in 1 month. If you go back to 72,
we'll see a billion-dollar election.
Yeah, I think so. But back in 72, I won 11 primaries, won the nomination, went to the national convention, found out the Democratic National Committee was broke. My campaign paid for the national convention. Then we had the general election against Nixon. The whole thing, from the day I announced for the nomination until I conceded to Nixon, $32 million. Each candidate is spending that much every month in this race. So I'm all with Jim Hightower on the need for public financing. We could then put some limitation on how much money went to each of the candidates, the challenger and the incumbent. And it's the only way to really ensure honest elections, the public financing of campaigns.
And by the way, Senator Dick Durbin has legislation in the Congress right now for national public financing of congressional races.
Well, Jim Hightower and Senator George McGovern, I thank you both for being with us. I know, Jim, you'll be tonight at All Souls Unitarian Church in New York tonight at 7. Senator McGovern, thanks for being here. Good to have you in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, Slavoj Zizic, one of the leading intellectuals in Europe today. He'll be in our Firehouse studio. Stay with us. This is not America. Charlie Hayden here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next guest has been called the Elvis of cultural theory, widely considered to be one of Europe's leading intellectuals. Slavoj Žižek is a philosopher, psychoanalyst, cultural theorist born in Slovenia. He's written more than 50 books, speaks to sold-out audiences around the world. In 1990, he campaigned unsuccessfully to be president of Slovenia, the first Yugoslav republic to hold a free election. He's in New York right now to give a lecture tonight called Resist, Attack, Undermine. Where are we 40 years after 68? The event opens this year's Left Forum. Slavoj Žižek joins us here in the Firehouse studio. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
When I asked you specifically how to pronounce your name, you said you're nervous about people who pronounce it correctly.
Yes, because but this is more a private trauma. Like, I don't like to see myself. Whenever I see myself, like, there on the screen, I'm tempted to adopt the position of an observer and ask myself, if I were to have a daughter, I would never allow that guy to take me to a movie theater. So,
you all said you'd be concerned if it was pronounced exactly, that perhaps that person came from the police.
Yeah, effectively, yeah, because only they really know. You know, this is at least my East European myth, that police are the ones who know.
This is a radio and a television and an internet show broadcasting all at the same time. We showed during Charlie Hayden's music break coverage of Prague in 68. This had an enormous influence on you. For an audience who would not even know what those two connections are, Prague 68, explain what happened and where were you?
It's quite by chance. I was very young at that point. I was in Prague. But okay, so that we don't lose time, there is something really tragic about Prague 68. Namely, let's be very frank, and it's something very hard to swallow for a leftist. What if the Soviet intervention was a blessing in disguise? It saved the myth that if the Soviets were not to intervene, there would have been some flowering, authentic, democratic socialism, and so on. I'm a little bit more of a pessimist there. I think that the Soviets, it's a very sad lesson, by their intervention saved the myth. Imagine no Soviet intervention. In that ideological constellation, it would have been either, sooner or later, just joining the West, or nonetheless, at a certain point, the communists still in power would have to put the brakes. It's always the same story. It's same in this, now you see my conservative, skeptical, leftist side. It's the same in China, Tiananmen. I will tell you something horrible. Imagine the communists in power giving way to the demonstrators. I claim it's very sad things to say, but if Tiananmen demonstrations were to succeed, like the Communist Party allowing for true democratic reforms and so on, it would have been probably a chaos in China. No, I'm not saying now that we should opt for dictatorship or some kind of a strong arm as the only solution. Just let's not dwell in safe illusions. I think all too often today's left falls into this prey, which is why they like to lose. And I think this is the original sin of the left from the very beginning. I still consider myself, I'm sorry to tell you, a Marxist and a communist, but I couldn't help noticing how all the best Marxist analyses are always analyses of a failure. They have this incredible, like, why did Paris Commune go wrong? Trotskyites, why did October Revolution go wrong? And so on. You know, this deep satisfaction, okay, we screwed it up, but we can give the best theory why it had to happen. I mean, this is to what my title, the title of tonight's talk, implicitly refers to, this comfortable position of resistance. Don't mess with power. This is today's slogan of the left. Don't play with power. Power corrupts you. Resist, withdraw, and resist from a safe, moralistic position. I found this very sad.
The second part of the talk, resist, attack, undermine, where are we 40 years after 68? Talk about what you see as the pivotal moments in 68 and where we are in relation to them now.
It's a very nice question. Why? Because precisely apropos 68, I think, we can see how, I will use consciously an old word, ideological struggle is still going on. Struggle for what 68 is. It's the same as I read here 1 or 2 weeks ago, a wonderful commentary on Martin Luther King, how every child knows here, I have a dream. Almost nobody knows what was that dream. It wasn't just racial equality. Martin Luther King moved way to the left later. That's obliterated. It's the same with 68. If you ask people today, what will you get? Oh, that wonderful explosion of creativity, anti-bureaucratic, sexual liberation, and so on. That's, for me, precisely the least interesting part of 68. That's the 68 which was perfectly integrated into today's ideology, self-expression, and so on. So if you want to draw the line, one line from 68, it is what for me, as an old-fashioned guy who likes erotics but with love, is the nightmare. Today's legacy of that 68 is alive in, you know, they have in California and now it's spreading to Europe a terrible thing called masturbaton. People gather, you masturbate publicly, you are not allowed to touch the other, and of course, each one has to pay some money which goes to politically correct causes and so on. And the idea is it's like self-expression, you are alone but in a crowd. This is what I don't like. But there is another 68 about which people don't want to talk. That crucial moment, I remember it, when something incredibly happened. Students, thousands of them demonstrating, establishing a link with workers. People tend to forget that France was on a general strike, that this wasn't just a student demonstration. Everybody would have swallowed that. So that legacy of 68 is worth saving. So it's not simple nostalgia. If we indulge in simple nostalgia for 68, it means sexual revolution and all that. So I would tell to those guys, go to masturbaton. Leave me alone. No. What? 68 was a dream and it failed. A dream of the possibility of these student protests reaching a wider audience. Of course, the game is over. My dream is not, let's do it today in that way. Unfortunately, I don't believe there will be a working class movement which will join with students. But there are still domains today where what? Let me ask you briefly, sorry, answer you briefly. What's the serious question today? I mean, it's fashionable to make fun of Fukuyama, no? Ooh, that idiot who thought history is over. But aren't we all today de facto, even the leftists, what would be the adverb, Fukuyamaists? Basically, we believe, nobody asks the question, will capitalism stay, will state stay? We basically accept the frame. Liberal democracy, as we, you know, in the old days we were saying we want socialism with a human face. Today's left effectively offers global capitalism with a human face, more tolerance, more rights, and so on. So the question is this enough or not? Here I remain a Marxist. I think not. I see a series of, to use this ridiculous old-fashioned term, contradictions, or I would have said antagonisms, tensions, from ecology, intellectual copyrights, new slums excluded, where I think in the long term the global capitalist system will not be able to cope with these tensions. Here is the true legacy of 68.
And now we're in 2008, and right here in this country, in the midst of this presidential race. I don't know how long you've been in the United States
but talk of the world. This may amuse you. When I was asked by an academic journal to say if I were to hold the power for one day as president, what, and I would have kind of absolute power to introduce a law, what law that would have been? My immediate answer was, not as some humanists suggested, since the United States at least think they are global empire, so let every adult in the world be allowed to vote. My advice would be the opposite one. Everybody in the world, except U.S. citizens, be allowed to vote and elect the American government. I think it would have been much better for you even. Because we all are outside the United States would project our desires into how you should be. I think it would have been better. So that only non-Americans vote for. I know this is a nightmare from Pat Buchanan or somebody like that.
And who do you think would win?
I think there would have been like left of Barack, if I may put it this way, no? It would have been probably, no? But going seriously, no? Of course, I am, my God, it's stupid to say for Barack and so on. But I see a tragedy here because, like, let's say he wins. What will he do? The tragedy of today's left is what? It's always the same story. Lula in Brazil, Mandela even. The good guy wins, we are enthusiastic. Then you have around 2 years, usually, period of grace. And then you have really to decide. Do you play with global capitalism or you want to mess with it? With this, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. Barack Obama can do things. There are many important gestures like Guantanamo, stop with these waterboarding jokes, open relations with Cuba, recognize, this would be incredibly important, recognize the Hague International Tribunal. I will tell you from my European perspective, this was perceived in Europe as the worst, let's say, ethico-political catastrophe of the United States. First, they push for international court, then they sabotage it. People ask today, why are such crazy nationalists in Serbia? I'll tell you, I spoke with them. They told me, first, United States push, they are still, sorry, I will be very brief, putting pressure on us, deliver Milosevic, Karadzic, all the criminals to Hague. Then the same people come and sign the non-extradition treaty. So. You are digging your own grave.
I have to break right now, but we're going to continue our discussion, and we will broadcast this week, part two. Slavoj Žižek is our guest, leading European intellectual, speaking at the CUNY Grad Center tonight, part two of our discussion in the next few days. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous. Happy birthday to Emma Missouri, as well as Dick Forstner. Aaron Mattei, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Robbie Caron, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries. I'm Amy Gavin. Thanks for joining us.